Well, here we are on this Tuesday evening, and not a normal show at all. This is Emmanuel Goldstein here with Kyle.
Hi.
We're just back from Iceland, but we're not going to talk about that tonight because we have something far more historic and important, and we'll get to what we've been through in weeks ahead. We actually, this is real history here, because not only did we just play the inaugural broadcast of WUSB 40 years ago to the minute, but as of a few moments ago, we have started broadcasting out of a brand new studio. We've moved out of the somewhat cramped third studio and into the first studio. We have so much space here now, I can't even begin to describe it. We can walk around and visit with each other and see all kinds of new bits of equipment. And the guy who made it all possible, Frank Burgert, is here. In fact, you might recognize his voice from the newscast you just heard 40 years ago. Frank is joining us here in the brand new studio. Welcome, Frank.
Oh, thank you very much, WUSB Stony Brook. Oh, God, where did that come from?
I had a question about one of the stories you read 40 years ago, and that was about the pot legalization. What's the progress on that? Has there been any motion forward? Because, you know, you're reading about that 40 years ago, and it just seems like we haven't gotten anywhere.
Have you been to Vermont?
And I also, but you talk about New York State. LIRR is going to go on strike on Saturday. What's up with that?
That's right. That's exactly the history.
Hot and humid itself. Tomorrow, 85 degrees?
Yep.
Wow. Okay, well, a lot has happened. A lot has happened over these airwaves. In a moment, we're going to be joined by our former general manager, Norm Preslin, over the telephone, which hopefully works. But this new studio, it's awesome. New equipment. Things so far seem to work just fine.
Yeah, it's very young.
How long has this been in the works for?
I would say 15 years.
Wow.
But we kept not getting a place to move to.
Uh-huh.
And then it happened very quickly last year.
That's how things work on college campuses. They are impossible until they become possible, and then all of a sudden they happen.
You do it right now. You're right. You move right away. We had literally a weekend to totally empty out of the old studios.
Wow. And I remember that was fun. That was a tremendous amount of fun. And in fact, there's bits of the old studio that have made their way over here. In fact, we just saw this on Sunday. We had our special 40th anniversary, not to the day celebration, 2 days before the actual anniversary. And Kiprit actually put together the old board from the old studio and encased it in glass. It's sitting out in our lobby right now, and it's just so incredible to see that old board forever preserved.
Left in its last state with the dust from the last day of broadcasting.
That's right. No, you don't clean off the dust. You can't do that.
You have to preserve it, sure, yeah.
Uh-huh.
With the labels that are falling off and the... Yeah,
it's preserved. It's a piece of furniture. It's
like taxidermy of a radio console.
A conversation piece. Yeah, people can look at it, reminisce, explain it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We are still transitioning here. We have this studio, which we're just debuting right now. I believe we have a total of four studios. Is that correct?
We have four control rooms. We built out two of them with this new equipment, and one of them, the one that's on air, that was on air as of moments ago, was put together with a lot of used equipment. But, still 20 years newer than what we had in the old studio.
What was it we had in the old studio? A lot of people are curious about that because it's older than most of the people who were using it. In fact, it's even older than some of their parents. Not kidding. It's from the 1960s, right?
The console, I think, was designed in 1962.
Yeah.
And this was we bought it in the late 70s. It was like the only one left in stock, and we got like the last new one.
So you're saying we went on the air 40 years ago today, the board we used was already old?
Yeah, it was already old. It was new, but it was old stock.
And we were using it up until this year?
Yes.
Wow.
That amazing.
Yeah. That is something. We could teach the world many things with how we make things work and last. And hopefully what we're building now will last for a long time as well.
Yeah, and different technology, but yeah, I would hope so.
How did you get involved with radio, Frank?
Uh,
No one's ever asked you this
no
before.
No one's ever asked me that. No, no. I think when I was a kid, I was playing with radios and taking them apart, and I built a transmitter, and then that was the beginning.
Wow. Didn't you, I don't know if you're allowed to talk about this, but didn't you also operate a station at a particular place once before this one?
Yes, in this, somewhere near this village for a year, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was non-commercial. Yeah.
Do you remember the frequency? Was it AM or FM?
It was FM. FM, yeah.
So you operated an FM station in the Stony Brook area before this one went on the air.
1974.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So you had a passion for radio before you even walked in the door the first time at WUSB.
Indeed, yeah. 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 I think my first job out of high school was working for a commercial radio station, one of those beautiful music stations, if you remember those.
I do.
Mantovani, all the strings. And
well, since they don't exist anymore, we can probably give the call letters, right? And talk trash about them.
That was WCTO.
WCTO Stereo.
I remember that? Yeah,
that was their ID.
Yep.
And it was a station a lot of people worked at.
Right. Even the program director at the time, which was Rich Koch, he worked there with me as well. I obviously did a lot of technical stuff. I drove the remote truck to stores where they did live broadcasts, you know, and sold things like paint and nails and shoes.
I think joining us now is our former general manager, Norm Preston. Norm, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Emmanuel, Kyle, and Frank. Good evening. I enjoyed a little bit of a time capsule over the last 30 minutes or so. It's true. I mean, many of those stories are still current, but it's kind of cool to hear about, you know, President Carter and Haldeman and Ehrlichman. it's a nice mix. So, indeed, that was 40 years ago, June 27th.
Norm, do you remember the actual day when this happened?
Yes, I do. The actual day itself. Yes, it was. The story, of course, has been told. Leading up to that day, we had picked June 27th as the day to begin broadcasting. We had received, the construction permissions to go, but there was a final permission needed, what's called a program test authority. So we assumed it would take a little bit of time, but not a lot. So we had weeks in advance planned for June 27th. And here we are, Thursday or Friday of the week prior, and we still had not heard anything yet. And, of course, the story has been told many times, more specifically by Frank and Rich, as they were involved, Rich Koch, that a call came in from the hospital saying a telex had come in, indicating that WSB had been given permission to begin broadcasting, and was that anything we needed to know? So they hightailed it over to the hospital, got the telex in hand, and then we knew that weekend that the reality of 5:30 on Monday was imminent. There was a lot of hustle and bustle on that Monday, of course, preparing for, you know, the broadcast itself starting at 5:30, so obviously the newscast, the people involved put that newscast together. People were milling around, of course. We had a party in a nearby room with the cake and all that. So once we finished the first announcements leading up to the Chuck Mangione concert, people walked over. I don't know if Frank remembers that, but we did walk over and partaked in some refreshments. The president of the then president, Dr. Toll, and the then student government president, Ishai Block, and other people were around. So it was a nice way to kick off the broadcast. We did the newscast. We had the Chuck Mangione concert. And then the first on-air host, DJ, was Bob Commodore. And the very first song that he played was All the Young Dudes.
Wow.
The Hoople, which at that time was a relatively new song. It's hard to believe. And then I do remember, I don't know, I think Frank came with us. So then we all left and we went to an Italian restaurant in St. James for a late night dinner. Frank, were you with that?
Yeah, I was at that. The first bad word go over the air while we were there?
Yeah. I think Bob Commentor got us off in fancy style with...
The first hour.
The first hour. So,
Norm, wasn't it literally the first 5 minutes when Ishai Block...
It might have been.
I thought it was Warren Zevon or something like that.
It wasn't in the Mata Hoople song.
So no, it wasn't in that.
Sometime after that.
But it was also Ishai Block, the student president, launched us into some controversy by talking about somebody who was in prison in front of the Stony Brook president, John Toll, correct?
Actually, Jerry was very helpful to the radio station when he was the student government president before Ishai, and he was a man of his convictions, and there were those moments when things would get heated on the Stony Brook campus, and indeed he was in jail that evening. So that was just not hyperbole. He was probably listening in his jail cell that night. So a very fun way to begin the broadcast history of WUSB. But really, it was a good-natured evening. And I do remember that Ishai and Dr. Toll, they got along fine. Dr. Toll was a very interesting fellow. He really was president at the time where a lot of the beginnings of Stony Brook really had to be ramrodded through very quickly, particularly the construction. And of course, there was a lot of controversy about the quality of the construction and the look of the place. But knowing what I know he had, the story was, he had a limited amount of time with a limited amount of money to do what Nelson Rockefeller wanted him to do in very specific orders. And he got a lot done in those years. And, in retrospect, Monday morning quarterback, but he was very good to us. He was very good, and actually at that time and throughout all these years, the Stony Brook administration was very, very supportive. Dr. Toll, Dr. Pond, hello,
yeah, where?
Dr. Pond. They were, they didn't quite, they supported the broader concept of a station at Stony Brook. And a little backstory to that is that when the State University Board of Trustees, came up with various mission statements, one of the statements was that as many of the university centers and four-year colleges would and should apply for a non-commercial FM license. And again, not to take a lot of time at this point, but, we're talking 1977. And when we went on the air in 1977, in the SUNY system, there were only a handful of stations already licensed. SUNY Buffalo had theirs, Geneseo had theirs, and Oswego had theirs. But they all operated as NPR stations with a full-time staff. So we were presenting something a little bit different. And in retrospect, the fact that Dr. Toll and Dr. Pond really understood what a station like ours could be and helped to shepherd it to people who may not have understood, why things were going to be different here than what they were used to, were very, very supportive. So, I listened to my comments on the tape earlier, and in 1977, it really was at that point, it was 7 years up to that point, if I really think about the various steps that had to take place at moments in time, ranging from moving into the Union in the first place, 69 to 70, that academic year, and that's when the studios, which eventually became the FM studios, the construction got underway. And then several years of working towards arranging for equipment loans and getting, the campus, to buy into this, and in a way where everybody would work together, and particularly at that time, not a lot of projects were the kind of project where the administration and the faculty and the students worked together on things. So again, that I think was key to moving this along, and we were able to apply. Well, actually, we were able to get the Board of Trustees to approve the idea of our station at a meeting in of theirs in June of 1973. So in June of 73, the Board of Trustees approved Stony Brook's request to begin the construction, or to begin the process to apply to the FCC for a non-commercial FM station. So that was June of 1973, and then we had the appropriate engineering consulting work done, with the studios being in the Union and the transmission location being at the time on the tallest building of campus, which was the Graduate Chemistry Building. The hospital didn't come into being until 1980. So in December of 1973, I remember taking the Amtrak down to Washington, D.C., and I personally handed in our application to the FCC. That was December of 1973. And then in January of 1974, Adelphi University, which at the time had a radio station, the 90.3 frequency, which is now run solely by Nassau Community College. Well, that was a shared time. Nassau Community and Adelphi shared that frequency. Adelphi eventually gave up running a radio station. But anyway, the point is that Adelphi University petitioned against our application to say, and we were first adjacent, meaning 90.1 for us, they were 90.3, and their engineering studies, quote-unquote, indicated that there'd be inappropriate contour interference, without getting too technical. But anyway, the fact that they put in a petition right off the bat meant that there'd be a delay. And it wasn't until October of 1975 that the FCC finally decided in our favor 100%. But that extra amount of time, again, in retrospect, I think the extra amount of time allowed, again, it was difficult for the students who were there at that moment because, you know, they had been waiting and they had been waiting and there was this delay. But in the long run, again, in retrospect, it probably was good that there was a bit of a delay because people got more experience. We worked out a wonderful arrangement with Sachem High School in 1975, where once a week, Wednesdays, I believe it was, from 5 p.m. to midnight, we would literally bicycle 7 hours of hour-long WSB programs and bring it over to WSHR, and they would run it for us, and they called it WUSB on WSHR. So people were on the FM dial, you know, on their station, 91.9. So it became real. You know, people were starting to realize that this is going to be real. And the other really funny thing, it's kind of hard to believe now, it seems kind of quaint, but the original application did not call for a stereo station. I mean, FM still, again, was still pretty in development, and the original application was not a stereo application. And between the time of the original filing and by the time we got to 1975-76, it became clear that, you know, it was necessary. So we were able to have one very interesting student government meeting where I think Rich remembers this better than I do, actually. There was a lot of joking around. There was always a joke in the student government, you know, that, oh, yeah, the radio station's going to go on the air. And there was this infamous statement by one of the student senators at the time who said, I'm going to go FM before they do. Now, that was actually kind of funny, and it was kind of funny. But anyway, there was one student, and of course I can't remember the person's name, but there was one person who really understood why stereo was necessary, and that person helped to engineer us getting an additional, at the time, $20,000 to buy the equipment necessary for stereo. So October 75, we get the okay. And then as we went through 1976 and early 1977, I do remember, I think, Frank, you might remember, in February, I think the tower was installed on GradChem. And if I remember, it was installed the first time incorrectly. They had to take it down and turn it a different way. I think it was...
Yeah, it wasn't pointing in the right direction.
It wasn't pointing in the right direction. And that was in February, I think, of 1977. And then, you know, those months leading up to June were really the months that we knew was going to be imminent, didn't know exactly when. And then June 27th kicked it off, and we've been there ever since.
Wow, what a story. That's incredible. Well, Norm, the question I've always had is, what was it that spurred you to get involved? What was the first day where you walked into what was WUSB in some form
and
got involved?
Well, that's a good question. All right, so, I came to Stony Brook as an undergraduate in 1969, September 1969. And the high school I went to, Brooklyn Tech, housed WNYE, the Board of Education radio station. So I had some hands-on familiarity with radio. And even prior to that, of course, I mean, you know, again, I'm of the age where, you know, when I turned 12, 13, 14, you know, 1964, I mean, that's the Beatles and all that stuff, WABC, WMCA, I mean, it really was, I mean, you know, people get tired of hearing the stories of older people talking about what a special time that was and a special moment. But it really was. And the power of radio, and it was, you know, the transistor, and, you know, the jokes. Dennis McNamara told the story the other day from LIR about putting the transistor radio under your pillow. I remember doing that.
Me too.
Listening to not only, you know, rock and roll, but baseball. You know, the Yankee games from, you know, California. You know, sticking under the pillow.
I used to listen to
anyway,
Jim Shepard.
Yeah. Music, clearly, listening to the radio, getting the experience at WNYE. And Eric, I think I've told you in the past, I did a little volunteer work at WBAI. In the church, they used to have the Saturday Night Live concert series. There was a student at the Brooklyn Tech who volunteered there, who was an engineering type, because, you know, a lot of engineering students at Brooklyn Tech. So I was a friend of his, so I would come occasionally, and I remember, you know, Steve Post and Larry Josephson and all those guys. And that was when they were up in the church, I think, on East 62nd Street.
Okay.
So I had some sense of, you know, non-commercial radio and, of course, the beginnings of FM rock, WNEW FM. So when I came to Stony Brook, you know, I was interested in, well, you know, what's here? And then I remember walking into the WSB office, which was located in the Pritchard Gym. And actually, if you go into the existing Pritchard Gym now, not the main arena, not the new one, but the old one, and you go up the steps like where the old entrance used to be, and you make a left, I think there's still a room there with a door, obviously, and that's where the WSB office was. The station was located on a second floor platform area looking into the gymnasium. It was like two small rooms. So that was September of 1969, and I started to kind of get involved with training in October, and Jim Weiner predates me by about a week or two. He got involved, I think, immediately in September, so I got to know Jim, and I've known Jim since, you know, September 1969. So that first year, 69 to 70, that's the last year the station was in the old gym. But then we moved that spring in April of 1970 over to the Union, which at that point had been open for about a half a year, but we had our space designated. But I do remember, you know, doing music radio shows on WSB AM 820, which was just on campus through a technology that just fed into the dormitories. And when WSB AM was not on the air, the station would simulcast either WBAI or WNEW FM.
Wow.
And then I remember, just like we just did that move just a couple of months ago, I remember in April, May of 1970, right around the time of the Kent State shooting, it was like that week, that we literally walked at that time our record library over to the Stony Brook Union. And the Stony Brook Union space for us at that time was the space that we've had all these years, but it was over the following number of years that the studio was actually built. We walked into a space that was two rooms that were separated by a brick wall, a small room, which people who visited the station may remember as the main door, which would lead into the station, and then everything beyond the wall of, I know I'm talking, people don't know, if they haven't been to the station, they don't know what we're talking about, but beyond the wall of the control room one and looking into conference and conference room two, all the way to the window in the back, that was one large room, And we operated there from like September 1970, and then as you reminded all of us when you found that note that I wrote on December 23rd, 1970, that's when we began building. I had totally forgotten, what I'm referring to for listeners is when the station was constructed. It was a time capsule of sorts was installed into the walls, some vinyl records, some other things, and a letter which I had totally forgotten, but really was a list of the people who, at least on that day, December 23rd, 1970, were the people who were working on that wall before that wall was sealed up.
And actually, there were three different time capsules that we discovered on that evening. And thanks to Kibret for tearing down the walls of the old facility, and also for encasing them so that we have them forever in the news studio. It was quite an adventure. Also, Norm, I don't know if you're aware of this, but whenever you mention Jim Wiener's name, he appears. It just happens. It's always been the case here at the radio station. And Jim, I want to welcome you to this 40th anniversary celebration.
Thank you.
And maybe you have some recollections of the early days.
Well, for one thing, I wanted to indicate that it is really a metaphysical wonder that I suddenly found myself here. I guess Norm had mentioned my name, and here I am suddenly. I found myself.
It's inconvenient, I know, when you suddenly
materialize. Oh, no, not at all. I'm not complaining.
Jim,
I'm just saying.
Jim, you came to the station, I think, a few weeks before I did. That's the story I told.
Immediately
in September of 69. I wound up there in October, I think.
I don't remember exactly, but when it was, but it would have to be, I mean, your recollection, I think, is definitely accurate. I would say it would either have to be September, around the end of September, or maybe around the middle of October, something like that.
Somewhere around that.
Yeah, I specifically remember sitting in my dorm room, which is kind of funny to me because I was in the Kelly Quad in the same dorm complex when I was starting out when I was a freshman that is immediately adjacent to these new facilities for WUSB.
And Jim, same with me.
It's extraordinary.
Same with me.
and I remember sitting in my dorm room one afternoon and looking through what was then the only campus newspaper, as far as I know, Statesman, and there was an advertisement indicating that anyone who might be interested in joining WUSB should come to a meeting that evening in the auditorium of the physics building here on the Stony Brook campus. And I remember becoming aware of WUSB somewhat before then, back around, I guess, 1967. I had gotten a catalog, a Stony Brook University catalog. I was a high school sophomore and was just taking a look at it as a possible college to attend. And I remember there being a brief mention of WUSB in the context of describing the student government, and in the indication in the catalog was that one of the organizations that the student government funded was a campus radio station, WUSB, and there was a picture, apparently, of someone who worked at WUSB at the time wearing headsets, controlling an audio console next to a turntable. I don't know who that person was, never found out. So I was intrigued even from let's say, 1967 on. And so here I was reading Statesman in the fall of 69, thinking, gee, I'd like to find out more about this. And I showed up at the auditorium of the physics building and met a gentleman named Ian Levitt.
Yes, Ian.
Who was, I believe, the news director at the time.
Yes.
And then shortly after that, I guess within a week or so, he gave me a call and asked if I'd like to do some newscasts. And I was very enthused about doing that. And that's really how it started for me in terms of getting involved at the station. And so that would have been, I think I might have done my first newscast sometime around the end of October was the first time I think I actually went on the air in 1960.
Right. When were you doing your second newscast, Jim?
And there is that classic
not yet, I haven't
program
yet.
Guide from around that time where it's you on the cover holding a microphone.
You know, you're right. You just reminded me of
that.
Wow,
I want to see that.
So
I want to see that cover.
Fall of 1969. I'm just going to say two quick things. Now that I remember, my cousin came to Stony Brook as a student a year before I did. So he came in 1968. And as I mentioned earlier, I was obviously very into music all these years, and Stony Brook, just as an aside, the history, of course, says that Stony Brook and the music that was brought to Stony Brook was just unbelievable in terms of all the bands and the acts that came to the university to play, like starting in around 1967, 1968. So I was aware of all the music that was coming to Stony Brook through my cousin Warren. And it's actually now, it's even more kind of ironic, because when I came out to visit him about two or three times, and besides, you know, the big bands that would come to Stony Brook, there was a bit of a local, you know, campus music scene. He was in a campus band. He played guitar. But there was this other band that would play like every 5 minutes, everywhere you turned, with the weird name Soft White Underbelly. And I would, like, see them all the time and hear about them. And, you know, I said, oh, that's a campus band. You know, I didn't really know much about what they were. So it's kind of funny as time went on that that band evolved into Blue Oyster Cult, and the person who put all that together was a guy by the name of Sandy Perlman, who passed away last year, who was a student government president back in 1966. And speaking of Kelly Cafeteria, where the West Side Dining, where the station is now, I don't remember exactly where they had concerts in the cafeteria of Kelly, and I remember going my second month as a student to Kelly Cafeteria because I heard that Soft White Underbelly was going to be giving a show there. And that's the day that I met Sandy Perlman, and I became friends with him for 48 years, Kelly Cafeteria. But Jim, tell the story of you getting that very important phone call because you were just doing something which just timing-wise worked out perfect. You know what I'm talking
about. Yes, I do.
Tell the story.
Yes, a group of us, you and myself and a number of other people, I may be a little sketchy on the details, but the specifics of it, yes, I'm not at all sketchy on. I know exactly what you mean. But as I remember, we were reinforcing at the time the campus reception when this was WUSB was just an AM campus only station. We were, I believe, putting some additional wiring around some of the buildings on campus.
Yes.
And if I remember correctly, This was around the buildings in the older dormitories,
yes.
G-Quad,
yes.
And on the other side of campus, where Kelly dorms were, it was happened to have been a more recently constructed, so it was the other side of campus, and I had a wash going in the, as I remember, in the basement of the dorm that I was living in at the time. So I briefly took leave from the project that we were doing at G-Quad and went over to Kelly Quad and went into the basement to collect my wash and put it in the dryer. And I probably went up to my room to get change for the dryer. And just by chance, my phone rang. If I'm remembering this correctly,
right.
And just by chance, I guess because my name was on a list of members of the radio station, someone from some administrative office or calling from an administrative office was indicating that a group of administrators from the central administration in Albany had come to the campus to inspect the what was then WUSB AM with a view towards its suitability for transition to WUSB FM. And had I not happened to be in my room collecting change for the dryer, none of us from the station might have even known about this because we were all out at G-Quad putting up this wiring. And so it was very, very chance.
Collecting change for the dryer, Jim. That was a pivotal moment in our history.
It was a pivotal moment. And I was able to say, yes, of course, we'll meet the individuals at the from the central administration at the radio station studio. And I immediately dashed back to G-Quad and let everybody else know that this was in progress. So we all headed over to the studios and were able to meet the people, and it actually turned out to be, as I remember, a very positive meeting, actually.
Yeah, and that's the meeting that led to the eventual SUNY approval to bring it to the attention of the Board of Trustees for their final approval. So, yes, that's exactly as I remember it as well. That was just by happenstance that you... You're very good at doing your laundry, James. It's a good thing that you did it that day.
This also reminds me, that story, of the particular circumstances at G-Quad where we were putting up this wiring around the dormitory. And my recollection is that, we definitely got permission from the university administration to do this. We didn't just take it upon ourselves, but we rented a nail gun to fasten the wiring to the outside walls of the building, and we were able to get permission to use a cherry picker truck.
Yes.
Where we were able to go into the bucket. I mean, nowadays, I don't know if under current law we'd have been allowed to do this.
I don't think so.
But this was all according to proper law and regulations. Nobody was breaking any laws or rules. But the funny part of it was the riding. Well, someone was driving the truck, and someone would be in the cherry picker in the bucket, and it would rise up two or three stories off the ground, and we'd be fastening the wiring to the walls. And this was during an intercession period, so there weren't too many students around. But as sometimes happens during intercession, there were a few students who did stay on campus. They had permission to do that and were in the dorm rooms. And one of the days that we were doing this, as we passed one of the windows, a couple of students happened to be occupying that room. But they didn't know the context of what was going on. They didn't know that there was a truck slowly driving by and that wiring was being attached to the wall. So all they saw was a person, one of the people from the radio station, riding by their second or third story window, apparently without any support, any physical support, somehow just floating in the air. And this person just smiled, gave a friendly wave, to them as he went by. And they were, of course, stunned.
1971, 1972. They probably said, "Well, that's pretty groovy, man." But let me tell you that to this day, if you walk around the old dorms, G&H, the residence buildings, if you look under the second floor windows in many spots, you'll either see a hole where there had been a bolt, or you'll see a bolt still there, or in some parts of the building, if you look very closely, you'll see the remnants of a very faded wire that is running right under the second floor windows, and some parts of the building, it's sort of continuous. It kind of goes through three or four windows before it just disappears.
Wow.
So there's still some evidence of that. But that's one of many, many great moments that historically can be looked back at now and say, boy, that was really something. That really was something.
Well, we're speaking with former General Manager Norm Pruslin and Jim Weiner, WUSB alumnus extraordinaire, who's been here pretty much since they turned the lights on. And remembering on this, the 40th anniversary of our first broadcast back in 1977. And we're also joined right now by Chris Phillips.
My goodness. They let him back in the building.
Yes, they
do. How are you, Mr. E?
I'm good.
First and foremost, I hate to interrupt the festivities. Jim, it is great to see you. God, I haven't been up here in like 6-7 months. So,
that's right. Where have you been?
The blue-black stuff.
Okay, that's your band.
Yeah. I don't want to do that now. But yes, I got very busy, and it took me away from something I was also very passionate about, which is this thing.
Okay,
that we're doing here.
As one of the younger members of WUSB, we have kids, all different ages are represented here, but how did you first get involved?
All right, I've told this story many times on the air, but that's quite all right. And it is actually directly related to two people in the studios at the moment, aside from Jim and Norm on the phone, who started this whole joint. I was roughly about 11 years old. I caught on the television that this wonderful thing as shock jocks are coming into fruition. I guess it would be the late 80s. And they made the fortunate or unfortunate statement that you could say dirty words on the radio after a certain hour. Whatever, safe harbor, which was after 10 o'clock. So I said, okay, I'm going to hear dirty words on the radio. So at 11 years old, I'm twisting the dial, and I come upon a talk show. And that talk show, at the time, was actually a long-running talk show here at this radio station, which was called, you missed your segue.
Brain Damage?
Brain Damage.
My show.
I was a Brain Damage listener.
Brain
and actually,
damage.
The first host of
I always thought you were a Brain Damaged listener. I didn't know you were a Brain...
I was talking about my brain damage.
That's right. See. So you listened to my old show called Brain Damage.
Yes.
Okay, now I get it. Wow.
So the first show I heard was with Matt, and then later on you.
Wow.
And from then on, I was a bit of a WUSB devotee. So I kind of... DJs I listened to, Steve Kreitzer, hopefully he's listening. Christina, who I saw just the other day, All Ages Show.
Wow.
Saw her just the other day. She says hello.
It's incredible because we had our 40th anniversary bash on Sunday, and I just saw so many people from the past. It was incredible just to reconnect with all of them, to see all the things that they've done, and to realize that WUSB has always meant something to them.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, another alumni I saw just the other day at the Blue Black thing was Decline stopped by.
Okay.
Who actually trained me.
Wow.
So, and then Finn reached out to me and said, hey, you want to do a fill-in?
And by the way, you're doing that tonight for Finn, because Finn is in Morocco.
Yes.
And we were in Iceland last week, and he's in Morocco this week.
Yeah, so. He's broadcasting for me in Morocco, and I'm broadcasting for him here.
Great. I see Chris LaPorta looking in from the other studio. We can say that now. We have other studios. And Chris, if you want to figure out how to get into this studio, it's pretty far away. And I see
we'll move the chair from
Matt
the
over there as well. And Bob Longman is floating around too, and Kyle is someplace. We have such massive facilities now that people can get lost and just wander around forever. It's pretty amazing. Chris LaPorta, now you helped build this new facility too.
Yes, I've been working behind the scenes. It's been pretty interesting. It's been a real gas, and actually to be broadcasting from CR1 for the first time.
This is the first night we've done this.
This is exciting. This is very exciting. Yes.
Wow. Indeed. It's pretty amazing. Who else we have in here?
I'm here.
Okay. Oh, there you are, Matt.
Yeah, Matt.
Wow, this room is so big. You snuck in without me even seeing you.
Yeah.
And you heard Chris say that the first time he heard Brain Damage, it was you who were hosting.
Yes, and he told me that some time ago, and I'm rather proud of that fact that we actually have a veteran DJ who I lured in here.
Uh huh. Yeah, I think we all are responsible, but none so much as Norm and Jim for getting so many people involved in this place, and we are forever in your debt, guys.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. We had an opportunity. You were referencing a few times already the Sunday lunch bruncheon, and that's something that every 5 years the station takes time to to work on getting a day together where we can really work towards getting a lot of people to come back. And it's become a tradition that every 5 years we do it. We'd love to do it more often, and maybe we will. A lot of people want to do it more often. But for now, 5 years. And they're always terrific. I mean, they're always great. It's an opportunity to take stock at what the station has done up to that point. In retrospect, it's a time capsule of things that were happening at that moment in time. Sometimes the guest speaker that we have might be tied into something that was relevant or timely at that time. Obviously, the people who attend, give a tone to the event. Oftentimes, we have acknowledgments from local politicians, so, depending upon who they are and what they say. University administrators, over the years have come, and of course, they come and go. So it's always very interesting to see what that mix for any particular luncheon will be like. But I really think that this last one, because I sensed it just by the vibe in the room, and Eric, you might have mentioned it beforehand, people just seem so happy, to see one another, and genuinely happy.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I've always was proud of at the station, and I think I mentioned it at the luncheon, is that usually people gravitate to people that they're similar to, and particularly at a younger age, you kind of go with your clique. The one purpose of college supposedly is to kind of broaden your outlook. But I think one thing that WSB has always been good at is brought together a mix of people who had one common goal, which was to bring their creativity and their knowledge and passion for doing radio together. And these people, many of them, would never have met one another in any other circumstances, because prior to coming together for the radio station, up until that point, they were either of different ages or different political persuasion or different sexual orientation or whatever it might be. But the common thread was the radio station, and people became very protective of one another, expecting high expectations of one another. And I sense that from people that come back all these years. And I mean, it's easy to say, well, it was the best thing I did when I was at school, et cetera, et cetera. But beyond that, I think that part of just the maturation process for a person, I think, was very an important contribution that the radio station has always made. And another thing which I think is just interesting as time goes on, as the station gets older, the range of people at the station, the age range continues to widen. We have our always incoming group of students, and then, of course, we have people who are committed and have been here for quite some time. And on one hand, it is a challenge to have an expectation that you throw all these people together in one organization, and the people who are responsible for running it are relatively young, and the people that they are overseeing are perhaps much more experienced and much older, and it's probably the first time that an 18 or a 19 or 20-year-old person has ever had to deal with someone maybe 20, 30, 40 years older than them that was not their teacher, that was not their parent, that was not their uncle, that was not their clergy person, that they were responsible for. And that's, I think, a wonderful learning experience, too. And I think a lot of young people don't get that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely, Norm. And that's something that's unique about WUSB, unlike other radio stations where only old people run it or only young people run it. This is something that is an amazing mix. And Kyle, I know you're one of the newer members of WUSB, one of the younger members, and I think you've witnessed that magic firsthand, haven't you?
Absolutely, yeah. As a relative newcomer to the station, I've noticed the community here, and what you all have done and what the station has done is remarkable. I'd say a complete fulfillment of the mission that you created and set out to accomplish, probably more so than you ever imagined. In fact, I was getting wanting to ask, did you have the sense of that from the get-go? Because as you said, a lot of you had just forged new relationships, did not know one another as this incredible community. And it's amazing now the history we have. You guys were talking about program guides. I wanted to say we could probably find that program guide with Jim Wiener on the cover. We've created this amazing history. And so did you know it would become this, that
yeah.
you would
I'll
changes in tech
and the importance? Jim, maybe you can give yours, and let me just start with mine. You already mentioned somebody's name who was the student news director at the time, Ian Levitt. Now, when I got involved, like you say, Kyle, you know, you go into it, you know, you come into this organization like you come into any student organization, unless you knew somebody that you went there with. And I know Jim went on his own, and I went on my own, so I didn't know anybody there, but I knew what I thought this would be like. So I didn't know who would be there. And Jim can talk about his experience, and he already talked about the people that he met. But I do remember that first group of people that I met, Ian Levitt was one of them, a fellow by the name of Bob Messing, who was the student general manager, a fellow by the name of Robert Kaplan, who was the technical person, a guy by the name of Sam Greenberg, who was sort of like the construction guy. So, and there weren't a lot of, you know, people involved. And also, in fairness, we need to look at the reality of the times. Most of the students in general at Stony Brook involved with organizations. It was a very homogeneous campus. It was not very diverse. And at the radio station, there were very few women involved. And I do remember the handful of women that were involved, and Jim, maybe you can correct me, they were like record librarians. I'm thinking of like Fran Muckenbeck, I think was her name. So this was, again, 1969, 1970, and in retrospect, you know, that's just a time capsule of the way things were. In terms of, there's that one photo that was on the table at the luncheon that is a picture of the staff from 1970 to 1971.
Yeah.
And there's about 15 of us there. We're all men. We're all Caucasian men. Half of us have hair down to the floor, and the other half have like crew cuts. And that was very interesting as well. And I know I'm jumping all over the place, but some of my fondest memories, I guess I was in the category of people that had very long hair. And a lot of the people at the station at the time did have very, very long hair, and with the exception of our engineering people. So, Jim, you may remember this. When we would go out to buy equipment, like at the AC Electric, which I think still exists,
yes,
on 347. So we would go out there, and those of us that looked, again, we're talking about 1970, 1971 in Suffolk County, those of us that looked a little bit like, you know, what are you guys doing off of the campus, we stayed back, and people like Sam Greenberg and some of Mark Kalman and like Dave Wald, who had short hair, you know, they did the transactions. It reminds me of like if you saw the movie The Last Waltz with the band. We looked like the guys in the band,
wow.
You know, the long coats and the hats and that. That's exactly what we looked like.
That's so cool.
But we had to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, we were doing business.
The appearances, yeah. Well, I'm so glad you guys found one another around this project. I guess I'm one of this newcomer era, the younger guys here that also has some long hair. So I guess that's still happening.
Yeah, Jim, do you remember those group that when we were running around and those of us that and you were probably obviously you had shorter hair, but your psyche was more in line with, you know, more eclecticism. What's your recollection?
I would say essentially what you said. That's my recollection. It was quite, to echo what you said, it was quite a terrific collaborative effort of people with differing interests. And also, to echo what you said, what's great is that as time has gone on, in terms of the overall demographics of the radio station staff, that the diversity has increased as diversity has increased in the world in general, that the radio station has come to reflect that. And some of the people you mentioned also calls to mind when you mentioned Dave Wald's name. I remember when I went to orientation as an incoming freshman in the summer of 1969, I made reference to that catalog that I saw when I was in high school about WUSB being at Stony Brook, and my first glimpse of the radio station actually predated that first meeting I went to in the physics building with Ian Levitt. I had some free time during one of the days of orientation, and so I ended up somehow finding out where the radio station was located in the second floor of the gym at that time. And I remember going up there. I distinctly remember that. And walking in, and who happened to be there but Dave Wald. And a new record, and I don't remember who the artist was, but a new record had just come into the library. And he went on the air with that record. And so my appetite was that much more whetted at that point, in between first seeing a picture of the radio station in the college catalog, and then when I first actually went to join the staff. So Dave was someone that I remember. The other names that you mentioned, of course, were very key people that I remember from that era. But as you said, people with some of them very different interests, but we all had the one main interest in a collaborative sense of radio, and it brought us all together. And it was, of course, very fulfilling doing radio, but also interacting with the people on the staff of course, we met then. And, of course, over the years, having come in contact with so many different people with so many different interests, it's extremely fulfilling, extremely so.
Well, guys, the time has just flown by. I want to thank you both, thank all of you, actually, for stopping in here this evening on this very special day, 40 years of WUSB Stony Brook. And wow, June 27th, 1977, that's when we first signed on the air. So much history has been made since then. So much has been put over these airwaves, and so much more still to come. So many minds to be inspired and influenced in various ways. So many people yet to get involved who will get involved in the years ahead, thanks to the efforts of you guys. And I just personally want to thank you both for being such an inspiration. I'm sure the whole station joins me in that. Jim Wiener, Norm Preslin, thanks. Thanks for joining us tonight.
You know, we realize that the radio station, it's a radio station. It's equipment, but it's the people. It's the people who program it. It's the listeners. It's the supporters. It's a community, and the real tribute should go to the, at this point, the hundreds and hundreds of volunteer students and community members and faculty and staff, alumni, who have come into that station day after day, year after year, sat in that chair, and continue to keep the literally like the fires burning in terms of what a station like ours can be. We always kid around saying, you know, the experiment continues and, you know, the road to radio, you know, but that's true. It's not easy to do this kind of radio. It never was doing this kind of radio in terms of funding and staffing and just the reality of running a radio station. But as times change and as trends change and as demographics change and administration people change, the premise and the thread that began to spool out 40 years ago today, I think, is still spooling quite nicely. So congrats to all of you, and here's to another at least 40 years.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Sorry, I'll just say I'll second that, and thank you for having me on.
All right, we are eating into Chris Phillips' time, filling in for Finn, who's over in Morocco. It sounds so awesome.
Wake up, Chris, wake up. You got a new radio,
All right, well, here we are, the 40th anniversary, a special broadcast. Thanks, Norm. Have a great
thank
night.
Thank you. Have a good night, everyone.
And
see ya.
We'll definitely be in touch in future broadcasts. I want to leave, though, with a memory from just a couple of days ago when some of us were conversing at the 40th anniversary celebration that we had. And that is that leads to a throwback to a show that I was part of back in 1982, where we were making some funny phone calls. And I think that's a good way to probably go out tonight. Stay tuned for Chris Phillips afterwards. Oh, you know what? And we also, at the end of this, we track down the old sea shanty ID, and we're going to play that as well. So get your tape recorders ready, folks. That's a bit of history for you. This is Emmanuel for Off the Wall. We'll see you next week. And now, here's another memory.
Yeah. Here with Mike Uhas, Jim Wiener, and Lister at the 40th anniversary WUSB celebrations. So good to see you guys.
It's very good to see you. This is really a wonderful event. It's really, really terrific to see everyone and to celebrate the multiplicity of effort over all these years and now culminating with the move and beyond, actually.
Yes. What's beyond?
Beyond, well, I think there's some foliage. I think there's some foliage outside the window there. Beyond it, as we continue to broadcast.
And Mike has come here all the way from Wyoming.
Wisconsin.
That's it. Yeah, one of those W states.
One of the W states. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Here I am.
Yeah.
Here we are. It's great to see you, E.
It's great to see you, too.
It's great to see you, Lister.
Wonderful being here.
It's great to see you, Jim. It's
terrific to see you.
It's great to see these hundreds of people here.
You have to go through all of them and tell them it's great to see them, too.
I will. In fact, I already have.
Can you name...
But there was no microphone in front of my face at that point.
No, there wasn't. I'm sorry about that. But can you name some of the luminaries who are appearing right now?
Well, Mr. Jim Dexter, Mr. Barry Reagan, Mr. Mark Stern. Brian Dinger is here.
Uh-huh.
Frank Burgert, Jerry Burgert, all of the Burgerts. Well, at least two of the Burgerts.
Lewis Heckheimer.
Lewis Heckheimer.
Brian Dinger, Betsy Dinger.
Right. All of them. Amazing. It's a great time.
It is.
You should have been here.
I don't know what I was thinking.
What, you mean he's not here now?
No.
Oh.
That's an apparition.
Intriguing. Intriguing.
I was never here.
So we're being interviewed by an apparition. By an apparition? By an apparition.
An aboriginal apparition.
I see.
Well, I'd like to say this is the only family I have. Let me make a correction in that. This is the only family we have. USB.
That's right. At 90.1 and 107.3.
Yes. And it's Sunday, and it's a party.
Yes, it's also...
That's right. I thought it was Saturday. Well, I thought you just came from your show, Lister, but it's Sunday.
You know, it starts with an S, right? Like WSB, dyslexically speaking.
Saturday and Sunday is a party.
Or a party.
Or a party.
It's a party or a party.
Are they a party or are they parties?
It's a party line. Yeah. It's a party line.
Yeah.
Gosh. Well, I guess there's nothing more to say now except the 50th.
Yes, onward to the 50th.
Mike, what's your most vivid memory from the Voice of Long Island?
Oh, calling Oscar's All Night Kosher Deli.
Yeah, every week we would make a phone call to some random city and ask the operator there, the information operator, for the number for Oscar's All Night Kosher Deli. I don't think we ever found it.
Okay, so where were we going to call now? Did we say Austria or Australia? I keep forgetting.
Austria. I believe one of our listeners wanted to get through to Austria.
Sure about that.
Yeah, definitely. Austria's a little country in Europe.
Australia is a big country down under.
Yeah, it is. Uh-huh. But Austria is... Australia is right next to New Zealand, which is what we just tried. So let's go to Europe and try Austria.
Okay. Well, this is another one of the continuing series of Voice of Long Island / Oscar's All Night Kosher Deli searches.
That's for certain.
I may help you?
Yes, operator. International information for Austria, please.
Certainly. What city?
What's the...
Vienna.
Vienna?
Vienna, sure. Hold on.
Thank you. Never could figure out the city we always wanted to see.
You know, we do know a lot of geography, come to think of it.
Yeah.
We always could come up with a city.
I'll put you on hold while you speak to information, so there's no charge for information.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Flashing back if you want to be connected to the number, okay?
Oh, yes, I will. Thank
you. Hold on.
Got to flash her back. Does that mean...
Don't do that. That's obscene. Now, I hear the folks in Austria sometimes don't answer their phones for a long time, so we might as well just talk for a while.
I thought that was Germany.
Well, Germany is sort of connected to Austria.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They're both right next to each other.
Remember when we were trying to get the zoo in Munich?
Yeah. It took quite a long time, didn't it?
Right. But
and that was a hostile operator.
No.
Although we were told it was a hostile operator.
But it turned out to be a real pal.
Yeah.
A real swell guy.
Yeah. But this person in Austria may never answer the phone, because, after all, what time is it there now? It's probably
2:28 here.
So that's probably about 6:30 in the morning. No, 7:30 in the morning. Hmm. But then they don't have daylight savings time.
How do you know?
Well, I don't think they do. They never talk about it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We're always talking about it.
That's a great ring, don't you think?
Besides, I don't think there's any way to say daylight savings time in Austrian. Ooh.
Hello?
Hello, is this Austria information?
Yes.
Yes, we need the number in Vienna for Oscar's,
yes,
for Oscar's All Night Kosher Deli.
Austria what?
Oscar's All Night Kosher Deli.
All night?
Yeah, open 24 hours a day.
All night? What?
Yes, Oscar's Deli.
Deli? Can you spell that to me?
Yes, Deli. D-E-L-I. That's short for delicatessen.
One moment.
Thank you very much. You must be.
Is she pulling the phone cord with her all the way across the room?
She could be.
That's what deli stands for. I always wondered. Delicatessen. What a funny word. Delicatessen.
So we're all set to write down the number here for Oscar's All Night Kosher Deli.
And you folks at home get ready to write it down, too,
you know,
so you can place your orders.
It could be in Salzburg.
It could be where?
Salzburg. Isn't that in Austria?
Salzburg is in Rhodesia. I know
no,
that
that's
much.
Salisbury.
Actually, it's in Zimbabwe now.
I thought that was a steak.
No comment.
You're better off. Bum, ba, bum, bum, bum.
They're looking in Austria.
Hello, sir. How you doing?
Yeah, we're getting our information, operator.
Good, okay.
Thank you very much.
Make sure they don't connect you, but flash me back. I'll connect you to the number.
And that's if we can get the number.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay.
Thank you.
That was nice of her to sort of butt in there.
Yeah, we've never had to never had to flash an operator before.
No. I have been planning on it, but you never know around here.
It's 13 degrees Celsius in Stony Brook. It's 55 Fahrenheit and really foggy.
It is very foggy outside. You can't see your face in front of you. It's amazing. Thank you, Mike, for that most intelligent comment you've made all night.
Yeah.
It is, you know?
Yeah.
You realize that?
No, I didn't realize.
Now you do.
Bum, 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 bum. This is fun, though. It really is. We just get a chance to babble on at length about...
Ooh, there she is again.
Hello?
Hello?
Sorry, I have nothing listed under that name.
Could you perhaps try Salzburg?
One moment.
Thank you.
There she goes again, dragging the phone behind her.
She's good, though. She's doing her job.
Yes, reluctantly, but she's doing it.
Yeah. Bum, bum, bum. I cleaned up that ink.
Listen to all the Austrian people talking. Well, they were there.
I cleaned all that ink up, by the way.
Good for you. You spilled it. You might as well have. There were Austrian people talking a second ago.
Remember when we were trying to get through to Iran during the crisis situation?
Yeah. We heard Austrian people talk. No, we heard Iranian people talking. Then.
And you actually spoke to the foreign minister there.
That was fun.
Yeah.
Except we didn't know it was the foreign minister when we talked to.